History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass, once a slave, became a brilliant and powerful leader of the anti-slavery movement. In 1852, he was asked to speak in celebration of the 4th of July.
Fellow citizens, pardon me and allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? I am not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. The sunlight that brought life and healing to you has brought stripes and death to me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There's not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour. At a time like this, scorching irony not convincing argument is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a stream, a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed, and the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced.
I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know how it feels to be free. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know. Wish I could break all the things that bind us apart. Wish you could know what it means to be me. And you'd see, you'd agree, everybody should be free. 'Cause if we ain't, we're murderous. Be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be. I already know. Jonathan Livingston Seagull ain't got nothing on me.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Hotep, my brothers and sisters, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. So happy to be with you here on another Tuesday evening. A very hot day here in Lithonia, Georgia, about 96 degrees. We are just so happy, though, that the weather is good and is nice. So wherever you are, I hope it's comfortable and that you have had a wonderful and a great day as well as a good week. So thank you all for joining us here this evening. We have a dynamic conversation that we're going to talk about. We got some wonderful guests online now who I know are going to contribute tremendously to this conversation. Our topic for the day is the butt-naked truth about education for African-Americans in America based on a historical perspective. We used to have an alderman in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. His name was Alderman McGee, very dynamic, strong brother who had a radio program. And he used to talk about, he said, today we're going to talk about the butt-naked truth. And so that's what we're doing this evening. Talk a little bit about education and really what is it that we can expect. Now, and not only that, but the depth of a discussion of education, what it covers, what it touches. You know, we're always talking about solutions. We're talking about healing. We're talking about resurrecting ourselves, our African selves. We're talking about finding the way. And the light, the torch for all of this is education. And so we want to address that. We want to address that as we relate to the family, the Black family, the Black community, and so forth. And so, we only have 2 hours, so we're going to try to cover as much of that as we can. But we're going to talk about the butt-naked truth for education for African Americans in America. As you know, this week is the week that this country celebrates the 4th of July, and I thought maybe that our orientation by the great Frederick Douglass would help put that in perspective for us here at the Black Reality Think Tank and for our listening audience. He raises a very critical question: what has that got to do with us? You know. And as the great Nina Simone said, I just want to what it feels like to be free. And that requires a discussion as well, because what is freedom and what is it to be free? Very clearly in this country, we have a long way to go. But the answer is in us, is with us, African people. So we must dig within ourselves and find that answer. So anyway, we're going to talk about that today. I hope that more of you will join. This is a call-in format, as you know, and you can call us here at 215-490-9832. And you can call to participate, ask questions, or just listen. And we are going to, as I said, move forward with this topic. Because whatever we do and all of the things that we try to embrace here at the Black Reality Think Tank, we do so in the spirit of the great Marcus Garvey, one race, one aim, and one destiny. And so that is our goal, that is our objective here, to move forward. I am not going to prolong too much of an introduction, I think, for our show today. As you know, one of the things that we always do is our ancestral profile, and I want to get right into that because I want to get right into our discussion. The great friend of Lou Hamer says that we must always praise the bridges that brought us over. Always praise the bridges that brought us over. And every time I even say that, each week that I say that on the show, I get like a little chill bump run through me. Because first of all, I get those chills because of who said it. The great Fannie Lou Hamer. Loved that woman. Powerful Black woman. Sharecropper. Mississippi country girl. Backwoods of Mississippi. Rural. She was born in a place called Rural, Mississippi. Had a chance to go down there to her memorial gravesite. Took a group of seventh graders down there and let them go and sit near her tombstone and just kind of rub in the spirit of this great woman. So anyway, she says that we must always do that. And so I want to follow that logic, and I want to follow that philosophy always in my life and praise those ancestors that brought us over. So today I want to talk about a very powerful woman. Some of us have heard of her, some have not. But I want to introduce her to those who haven't at the Black Reality Think Tank. And I want to just kind of reiterate that among those who have heard her. Her name is Fannie Jackson Coppin. Fannie Jackson Coppin. C-O-P-P-I-N. Fannie Jackson, is her maiden name, was born in the period of enslavement. So she was an enslaved African in Washington, D.C. on October the 15th, 1837. She gained her freedom when her aunt was able to purchase her at the age of 12. Through her teen years, Jackson worked as a servant for the author George Henry Calvert. And in 1860, she enrolled at Oberlin College in Ohio. Oberlin College was the first college in the United States to accept both Black and female students. And I want to talk in the future about Oberlin College here on the Black Reality Think Tank and take a look at some of that and help us understand what that was all about. There's a lot of African-American women attended Oberlin College. So we want to kind of talk about that as an educational factor. But while attending Oberlin College, Jackson enrolled and excelled in the men's course of studies. She was elected to the highly respected Young Ladies Literary Society and was the first African-American student to be appointed in the college preparatory department. As the Civil War came to an end, she established a night school in Oberlin in order to educate freed Africans. Upon her graduation in 1865, Jackson became a high school teacher at the Institute for Colored Youth in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The Institute for Colored Youth in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Within a year, she was promoted to the principal of the ladies' department, and she taught Greek, Latin, and mathematics at the Institute for Colored Youth, which was a high school for African-American students in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I know Brother Timothy's got his ears perked up when I said that. In 1869, Jackson became the principal of the entire institute, making her the first African-American woman to receive the title of school principal, a position she would hold until 1906. In addition to providing African-American youth with education, Jackson founded homes for working and poor women. She also was an influential columnist who defended the rights of women and blacks in the local Philadelphia newspapers. Jackson added missionary work to her long list of accomplishments when she married a man by the name of Reverend Levi Jenkins Coppin. Reverend Levi Jenkins Coppin, a minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church on December the 21st, 1881. In 1902, the married couple went to South Africa and founded the Bethel Institute, which was a missionary school which emphasized self-help programs. Coppin was also, after a decade of missionary work, she returned to Philadelphia because of her declining health. Fanny Jackson Coppin died on January the 21st, 1913. In 1926, a Baltimore, Maryland teacher training school was named the Fanny Jackson Coppin Normal School in her memory. It was called again the Fanny Jackson Coppin Normal School in her memory. It is now Coppin State University. Frances Coppin. Okay, my brothers and sisters, let's prepare. I thought I would choose her. Because of the fact that we're going to talk about education. And many of you may have heard of Coppin State. It still exists, still has a student body. A wonderful opportunity for people living in that Baltimore, Washington, D.C. area. I had a very good friend that was chancellor of Coppin State. His name was Dr. Stanley Battle. He was at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee for a while. He left. And we went to Coppin State as their chancellor, served a few years. Then he went over to A&T State University in Greensboro as their chancellor. But anyway, Coppin State, dynamic school. Let me just also mention real quickly, the Black Reality Think Tank is a part of a network called the TimeForAnAwakening.com. TimeForAnAwakening.com, which is also a part of the Black Talk Radio Network. And there are several programs that are on this network. Ours is just one of several dynamic programs that present some wonderful, innovative discussions and topics. And real quickly, I just want to mention that one of them is a program that airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, called African Perspectives, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And that program is hosted by Brother Oshieme Adelabu, who is also the executive director for a network called Motherland Media Network. And that network also sponsors the Black Reality Think Tank here on the Tuesday evenings here on this station. Also on Mondays from 1 to 3 p.m., Monday and Wednesday from 1 to 3 p.m., is the Black People's Matrix with host Brother Franklin Jones. The Black People Matrix hosted by Brother Franklin Jones every Monday and Wednesday from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. And then on Monday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., we have Acres of Diamonds. Acres of Diamonds, Monday evening, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And again, all of these are Eastern time. And then on Monday evenings from 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., we have Let's Buy Black 365. Let's Buy Black 365, Monday evenings, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern time. And then, as you know, the Black Reality Think Tank on Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. And then on Wednesday from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., we have Revive, and the host is POC, which stands for Proof of Consciousness, every Wednesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. And then on Thursday from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m., we have Relationships with Joy and Troy. Relationships with Joy and Troy. And then on Friday evenings, we have from 8 to 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot, who is the general manager of that network, as well as Brother Richard. And they both have, as I said, dynamic guests, very innovative discussions, but they are every Friday evening from 8 to 10. And then again on Sunday, they have a dynamic discussion as well, and they discuss the whole idea of the politics throughout the nation, throughout the world. And they had a wonderful dynamic conversation that I was supposed to join them on last Sunday. They were talking about Reconstruction and what that means for us today. And I think that did a magnificent job. I wish I could have gotten on. Had some difficulty with my telephone, and so I could not call in and participate in that conversation. But it was dynamic. I did get to hear it. But that was every Sunday from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Time as well. Don't forget, on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern Time, a program called Saturday Sports Talk with host Troy Wilmore. Saturday Sports Talk. Troy Wilmore, Saturday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. Eastern Time. And then Revive again on Sunday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. With POC, Proof of Consciousness. So this is the lineup of programs here on Time for Awakening. You can go to the website, www.timeforanawakening.com. All of the majority of the programs are archived. A lot of our programs are archived here at the Black Reality Think Tank. African Perspectives is archived there as well. You can go and listen to any of the programs 24/7 and enjoy and have a good discussion. We welcome you here at the Black Reality Think Tank to also take a look at our Facebook page called Black Reality Think Tank. And you can have an opportunity to see some of our upcoming programs. Plus, I also post programs that we have aired as well as other information that supports a lot of the things that we're talking about. So I do offer books and resources that we can look at because I really would like to encourage our listeners, for those who are not already involved in study groups, to back up, you know, things that you hear and what we say. Don't, you know not to take anybody's word for it without backing it up. You know, not saying that they're being untruthful, but for your understanding, it's good for you to research it and determine what your perspective is of all of those things. So anyway, I wanted to do that. I wanted to start off by offering that as a part of the system here. And like I said, it's just a great opportunity for me to do that. So the butt-naked truth about education, butt-naked truth. And I thought it was a very timely thing to do, particularly in relationship to the week here, the 4th of July, and this country's honoring that as a holiday. And as I sit back and I reflected on that whole idea, and you know, talking about the document called the Declaration of Independence, I recalled a book that I read, reading not too long ago, and I still continue to read it by Kehinde X, called Stamped from the Beginning. I love that book. What he does there is he does a whole historical research on racist ideas and where they come from and how they infiltrated into the system. And so one of the questions that we ask a lot about the American system and its early years is that this document called the Declaration of Independence, and the fact that it stands for freedom, liberty, and justice, and the pursuit of happiness. And then at the same time, it implemented a system called slave trade. In this case, in America, it was called chattel slavery, which was the worst form of slavery that there can be, which means property slavery. And how can you have a document like that And if you've ever read the Declaration of Independence, you know what some of the wording in there is. How can you do that and have a constitution and talk about liberty and justice and then operate a system as cruel as slavery? That's a question that's often raised, and I think that's what Frederick Douglass was definitely relying upon when he talked about that speech about what has that got to do with African people. And even though at the time he was delivering that speech, we were in captivity. The system of captivity was legal. It was a legal system being practiced by all of the 13 colonies at that time. And even some of those newer states that were coming in, getting their charters, all practiced slavery. The whole American economic and political system was established on the system of slavery. The captivity of African people. It's everything. The Declaration of Independence, the Star-Spangled Banner, the U.S. Constitution, the Uniform Commercial Codes, all of those items were established on slavery. And you cannot deny that. Now, what that means is that it's rooted deeply into the fabric of the American system. So as we are preparing to change and trying to find ways of dealing with, and some of us want to try to look at the system as finding ways of changing, that all of that has to be taken into consideration. So the Declaration of Independence and eventually the U.S. Constitution were created from the philosophical principles of what was known at the time as the French Enlightenment. And you would have to take a look at that and read that, and we'll see what that means and, you know, go into the depth of it. But the Jeffersonian idea of writing the Declaration of Independence came from that philosophy system, as well as some other things. And those who framed the wording of it were framing it based on that whole idea. This school of thought supports the idea that the right to life is granted to each individual by his creator. So our right to live and breathe is granted to us by God. It states that the human rights that the individual wishes to protect are basically simple in nature and includes the right to life, the right to liberty, and the right to property. So in essence, these three rights are actually one right, which is the right to life. Based on these ideas, in our case, the government do not need to take a man's life to kill him. You don't have to kill a man in a lot of ways to take his take away his freedom. They can remove his right to property or freedom to produce the property needed to maintain his life. So you take away his ability to take care of himself and his family, and immediately you have choked him. And that is basically what the system of slavery did. Without the right to keep what he has produced, which is his property, man will surely starve to death. He will starve both physically and spiritually. So not only must man be allowed to keep the products of his labor, he must be free to produce the property he needs for his subsistence, which is the right we know as liberty. This system of slavery in America argued that the right to life for Africans was a privilege granted by government. It was not a right granted by God. And that idea that it was not granted by God basically came on the idea that the African was not a part of the Adamic family. And that starts with the church, that starts with Christianity, and that starts with some of the philosophy coming out of that, that God only created an Adam and Eve, if you look at the creation story, and he created them, and they both look like Europeans and not like Africans. And so that idea is undergirding all of this, is that God did not create the African. The African was cursed. That's why the the curse of Ham and some of those theories become very important in looking at that. There's a book that was written by a historian by the name of Winthrop Jordan called White Over Black. And he documents in that book the whole idea of where that came from and how it permeated itself into the society and how it permeated itself into the philosophy of American life. And this is at the root of the system, because you must remember all of the American early rules and regulations and laws come from the church. The setting up of the 13 colonies are based on the Europeans' desire for religious freedom. So the Protestants were the ones that were coming over, mostly setting up the colonies. Episcopalians, Presbyterians, United Methodists, Baptists, the Catholics too, but basically this was being controlled by the Protestant movement that wanted to practice their religious freedoms and ideas. And as I said, undergirding those religious freedoms and ideas is that the African was inferior and was not a human being. And that their job was to civilize those beasts and to make them human. That is the bottom line. And that was at the helm. So that's why it was always questioned in those early years, is do we Christianize the Africa? I published a book on our Facebook page not too long ago. It's written called How to Christianize an African. And there were a lot of people that believed that should not be done, and they believed that it could not be done. It would be like saying you want to Christianize a dog. Let's turn all dogs into Christians. And obviously the response would be, how you going to turn a dog into a Christian? He can't even talk. He doesn't read. He's ignorant. He doesn't come from our quality of life. He's not a human being. His ancestors walked on fours. They were cannibals. And so those ideas are permeating the structuring of the American system. And so this is at the helm of things. Now, the other thing real quickly to remember, and I've got to jump around a little bit because it's just too much to cover in one sitting. But remember, all of the educational institutions in early America were founded by the church. The church educational system for the development of education in America. United Methodists, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Catholics, Baptists, Pentecostal, all of it was started by religious schools. All the universities, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Duke, William and Mary, all of them had histories rooted in from Christianity. There is another excellent book. If any of you, I'm just giving you some resources, because then you could go back and you could look at it yourself. That was a book by a historian by the name of Merle, M-E-R-L Curti, C-U-R-T-I, Merle Curti, and the name of a book was The Growth of American Thought. And he's from the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And he talks about that early history, and that a lot of the development and the settlement of the American land was based on religious ideology, right up to the whole idea of the principle of evolution versus creation. That's also rooted in that system of beginning. When Lewis and Clark were going to explore America, and if you read Merle Curti's book, you can see this in there. Jefferson gave him some underground instructions. They wanted them to go and obviously find what was out there, what were resources were available, what was out there. But they also wanted them to find evidence, strong evidence, that evolution was the reality principle. for life on the planet Earth. And so he wanted them to use plants and to sort of graft samples and to look at things that could support the argument that evolution was at the helm of the world, of the planet Earth, in terms of growth and life, as opposed to creation. The church was more obviously supporting the creation. And you were not allowed to raise the evolution question, because you remember that even right up into the early 20th century, the late 19th century, there were court cases about teaching evolution versus creation. And those became big theories. And at the helm of that was the ape and plant life. And the African was also a test model of all of that history as well. So this is the foundation of early education in the United States from the 1600s, 1619, right on up into the middle of the 20th century. Even still today, a lot of that is still practiced. So as a historian and as a philosopher of all of this, that means that the whole ideology of America has a problem that lurks at its roots. And that problem is embedded very deeply. And those of you who are engineers, you know that when you have a problem in the foundation of something, that problem is not going to get better by building on top of it. And so as you build on top of it and continue to grow, if there's a problem down at the bottom, at the foundation of that, as it grows higher, it's going to have trouble. And eventually it will topple. It's like even biblically they say you can't build a house on sand. And so these principles and ideas are at the root of American life, and it's lurking there. And what we are doing is we're trying to logically try to produce, you know, correct conclusions from false premises. We're trying to say that freedom and liberty is now available to all of us based on a system which was rooted in slavery and rooted in the idea that the African was inferior. And see, that never changed. It didn't evolve. As we got better, and your Du Bois, that's why one of the things that Du Bois did, he put out a book about how great Africans were and all the good things we did. That's not going to run that away. That's not going to evolve that away from those who have the power to change that. So these false conclusions, which are being developed from false premises, you know, do not provide for accuracy. So what we have to do, I think, and this is why I'm having this discussion, is that we have to understand what is it that the basic foundation was. Because it's that you're going to have to use to move forward. And that's why everybody says we must do for ourselves. See, the only way for us to reverse this process is to restore our true self-image. Forget about all this stuff other folk have said. Forget about TV and reality TV and all the stuff that we've heard about African and African people. That's why it's so important what Carter Woodson said. Carter Woodson said, he who controls the past controls the present. And he who controls the present controls the future. That's what that means. That's what he's talking about. All this past stuff, if you're controlling what's said, you're controlling the writing of the textbooks, you're controlling the movies that come out. They told us all the way up into the 20th century that we had evolved from gorillas. And that we were, they kept making movies, King Kong, that movie they had recently about the Planet of the Apes and all that stuff. That's what you think they're talking about. These are human apes walking around with shotguns talking you know, and acting like they're human beings. And they're trying to, that's the statement being made there. So we've got to control the past. That's why it's necessary to introduce our children to the greatness of from where we came from. We got to introduce them to the power. Dr. John Henry Clark said that Africa is our center of gravity. It is our cultural and spiritual mother and father. That's what he said. It's our cultural, spiritual mother and father. It is our beating heart, no matter where we live on the face of this earth. And we've got to keep bringing that to our people. So until you develop yourself to the level of a supreme spiritual being, at which point you live through time backwards, so to speak, when you become the architect of your own future, that's critical. You got to become the architect of your own future. You got to build your own future. You simply will continue to live to see how you arrived at your destination. But that's another story. And that's basically the principle of Sankofa. Going back and retrieving what was lost so you can move forward. That is the whole idea of the Sankofa principle and the Sankofa idea. That's when we talk about the way. That's what we're talking about. Because what we did is we had that. We had that at one time. We had the Sankofa, and then came the Ma'afa. The Ma'afa is not who we are. That's what happened. And so now as we struggle through and out of the Ma'afa, we must now find Sankofa and move back to the Sankofa. And so that's the idea, my brothers and sisters, of looking at education. Education has to speak to that. Education has to address that. I mean, I know you got to have the math and you got to have the biology and all this other stuff. You got to do all that, and I'm not suggesting that you don't have that. But we've got to go back home and look at home and how home was done. Africa is our center of gravity, and I repeat that. It is our cultural and spiritual mother and father. It is our beating heart, no matter where we live on the face of the earth. That's what John Henry Clark said. Wade Noble says, he says that a people's indigenous culture anchors them to reality, and it must be the starting point for all learning. Listen to this, my brothers and sisters. Let me say it one more time. A people's indigenous culture anchors them to reality, and it must be the starting point for all learning. Hence, placing children or centering them within the historical setting is key to fostering educational excellence. Dr. Wade Knowles. And I know, I'm by no means am I saying that you don't know this. I'm just reiterating it. I'm just saying we talk about capturing the African mind. We talk about resurrecting us from the dead. We talking about change and this. This has got to take place in the process of change. There's no other way that change can happen if you don't look at this whole idea. So we must be. Martin Luther King even understood very clearly. We haven't given Dr. King the credit that we need to give him some time for the work that he's done. But Dr. King said that education, which stops with efficiency, may prove the greatest menace to society. The most dangerous criminal may be the man gifted with reason, but with no morals. So along with our educational process goes the whole idea of instilling with that the whole morals. So I guess what I'm saying is that we've got to tell our story to our children, and we've got to tell it our way, because this goes like the old African proverb says, until the lions have their historians, the tales of the hunt shall always glorify the hunter. And that's what we've had in our books. I didn't learn about Africa. Oh, man. I definitely didn't have it. And I'm not taking, because I went to an all-black school. I went to segregated schools. And they didn't teach Africa. What they did teach, no, I'm not, I'm sorry. I don't recall any of that at all. I did not get Africa until I had graduated from high school and went to New York and went up to Michelle's bookstore and listened to some of those lectures as they talked about Africa and the pyramids and all that stuff and the Great Kemet system and all of that. I was blown out of the water. I said, what is this stuff? I was 18 years old trying to figure. I never heard of that. And then I got a book called The 100 Amazing Facts of the Negro. Got another book from the J.A. Rogers wrote, talked about all the greatness of Africa. And so that kind of opened up my eyes into all of this. And it just really made a world of difference. And so that's why, you know, Carter Woodson, when he did the Miseducation of the Negro, this is basically what he was saying. This is all he said. He was talking about doing for yourself, learning from who you are. He said, unless African Americans, at that time the Negro, unless the Negro receives an education befitting to their peculiar situation, they will never enter fully into the economic, political, and social institution in the United States of America. Now, did you hear that? This is now here. We said, I told you the name of the program today is The Butt Naked Truth About Education. Now, here is the butt naked truth. Again, I repeat, Carter Woodson, unless African Americans receive an education befitting to their peculiar situation, and that peculiar situation is having gone through the transatlantic slave trade, gone through the Jim Crow years, they would never, never enter fully into the economic, political, and social institutions in the United States of America. He went on to say that the mere imparting of information is not education. Above all, the effort must make a man think, must make him think and do for himself. The program for the uplift of African Americans from within to develop in him the power to do for himself. Marcus Garvey, Honorable Elijah Muhammad, Noble Drew Ali, Malcolm X. That's what they said. That's all the stuff they were trying to teach us. And we didn't listen to any of that, it appears. We didn't hear that. We went running up there talking about Plato and trying to understand the Greek philosophers. Man, come on. And he goes on to say, to educate African Americans, we must find out how to begin with him as he is. So you got to go out there in the backwoods of Mississippi and tell him to put down the plow and come here, let me talk to you, and make him a better individual of the kind that he is. You know who's doing that? Saban from the University of Alabama. He goes out there to the backwoods of Mississippi, Alabama, and get them big 6'3", 280-pound football players and train them into football, which basically does not necessarily mean that they're going to produce in the kind of men that they should be. But this is the way he did. Now, we got to take that same principle and go get those big brothers and get those sisters out there in those backwoods and turn them into thinking human beings. That's what we have to do. But I read this article about Saban. This was one of the key things that he used to do. These are the things that our ancestors, one of the things that Asa Hilliard, who was very powerful brother as well, he was an educational psychologist, who's written tons of stuff on educating children. He, Dr. Amos Wilson, Brother Marcus, that one of our regular hosts came on and talked about them last week and the work that Amos Wilson did. And like he said, there's a whole bunch of stuff out there on YouTube. He talked about awakening the genius of the African child. And if you read that book, everything that he says in there is the same stuff that I'm telling you Carter Woodson said and all of these other thinkers and philosophers have told us to do. And I just can't figure out why we're not listening to that and doing that. Dr. Hilliard said that what slavery did, which is why you have to look at it and have to begin to move on it, is that it created five things. One, it created genetic low self-esteem. It created that and passed it down the line. It took that out of us through pain and suffering. It took it out with the whip. It took it out with the gun. And he took it out with the penis. The rape of the African woman and bred it in him, the seed from the captor, and put that fear deep down inside of the African genetic makeup. And so it was passed on, this genetic low self-esteem. It also created cultural confusion. It made it so that we didn't understand Africa. They told us that we were walked around with no clothes on. We had bones going through our nose and plates in our lips. So that was foolish and ignorant. We didn't understand that those were cultural messages. Those kinds of things. We were confused about that. And so as we moved into the center of the century, we decided we want to look like white people. We don't want to look like them old ugly, big-lipped people with plates in their nose. We're gonna dye our hair. We're going to go here and put some conchylene grease and some lye in our hair and make it straight so when we sing, we can shake our head and the hair fall back. We're going to sit down in the kitchen and straighten our hair with a hot comb and all kind of chemicals in there. We were culturally confused. We thought white was beautiful. We thought it was great to have blue eyes. We went even out here and bought blue eyes. We bought chemicals from the drugstore that were supposed to make us lighter. That stuff was killing us. Black and white ointment, Palmer skin success. Cultural confusion, my brothers and sisters. We were trying to look like who we were not. Are we still doing that today? Well, you answer that. Cultural misalignment. We were trying to culturally align ourselves with people, even through marriage and sex. We wanted to align ourselves with individuals that were not a part of us. It threw us off. It made us so that we changed the bloodline of our families. We wanted light-skinned wives and light-skinned husbands and curly hair people and all of that stuff. There's a cultural misalignment. We wanted to wear Brooks Brothers suits and wingtip shoes, dress up like that. We were confused, Dr. Hilliard said, about our culture. Self-hatred. We didn't like ourselves, so that means I ain't like you either. Brother Neely Fuller has a piece that he talks about that. We would pass another brother on the street. What you looking at, nigga? Don't be looking at me. Where the hell you think you is? Get out of my face. Bah, 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 bah. And we don't like ourselves, so I damn sure
call
don't like
recording you. Off.
And they're surely not going to like you. And then spiritual indifference. We were taught to embrace gods that had no reflection to Africa, had no idea, no concept of Africa. The white Jesus was a problem. Is a problem. I know my Christian brothers and sisters that are out there. I'm not saying that Christianity was necessarily a problem in itself, but there are some problem issues. That's why the theologian from Howard University Divinity School wrote a book called Troubling Biblical Waters. There's some problems with the way we interpret Christianity. There's some problems with the way we interpret the scriptures. I'm not saying, I'm not one to say throw the Bible away. I'm like John Henry Clark. Don't throw it away. It's got some good stuff in there. But there's some stuff we got to go in there and reteach. Black preachers have got to reteach that history. That ain't correct. A lot of that's not correct as it relates to us. And so we have to get in. Like I said, I just don't have enough time tonight to get in there and deal with that. So I'm going to kind of stop at those points for a minute. And then I'm going to I'm going to open up, let our audience talk. I said we got some folks that are online, give you an idea to talk about it. I'll come back to some of this discussion because there's a lot more to this educational process, because as we go into the 20th century, it gets worse and worse. Let me add this one point. When slavery ended, and I'm sure Brother Elliot and Brother Richard talked about this on Sunday, one of the big questions around 1860, well, actually it started before this, started around 1840, 1850. The question became, okay, look, this is among white power creators of white system. They began to say, slavery is not going to hold up. That's going to be a problem with slavery. We're going to have to give it up some way or the other. It's going to create some havoc. They even predicted the Civil War long before it came. That's why there's a lot of books written. There's one book written called The Gathering Storm. They saw it coming. They saw it. It was going to come to a bloody clash because you're going to have to give it up. And one of the questions became, well, what are you going to do with the black folks there? When we give it up, what are you going to do? What are you going to do with them? And it became a political platform called the Negro Question. What are we going to do with the Negro? Meaning when slavery ends, what are we going to do with them? One question, one answer came back. They will send them back to Africa. All the way up to James Monroe. Monroe even saw that. He was real early. Late 16th century, I mean 17th century, he wanted to talk about ways that could do that. That's why in Africa, Liberia, the whole development of Liberia, and the capital of Liberia is called Monrovia, after James Monroe. But anyway, he proposed it, Lincoln proposed it, to send the Africans back to Africa, create a colonization movement. And most of the early colonization movement was started by whites. It wasn't blacks that started that, even though Paul Cuffy and Prince Hall were very active in wanting to go to do a back to Africa movement. But most of that came from whites, and they wanted to send. So that was one answer into the Negro question. The other answer was assimilate them into the culture. And people said, oh, no, that ain't going to work. Even Lincoln responded to that. He said, you'd never be able to put black folks working with white folks. They'll kill them. They'll exterminate everything. So that's not going to work. And most people said that. And even those that would have done the extermination said, no, they don't assimilate it with me because they're not going to go to school with my kids. They're not going to live next door to me. So assimilation is definitely not the question. And then another idea popped up. Well, let's segregate them, give them their own piece, and let's segregate them. And so you get the idea of 40 acres and a mule, and let's give them their own property and separate them. No, they ain't gonna do that either. Because who's gonna plant cotton? Who's gonna pick cotton? Who's gonna pick tobacco? Who's gonna do the sugar crop? You know, we not. Somebody's got to do it. And so the whole idea was that the African would still have to be the one to do it. So if they're still here, what are we going to do with them? How are we going to develop? And so if you go back and you look into the literature and the legislation of places in the South, as well as the North, around the question of the Negro, and there were some people that just write out, well, look, just exterminate them, get rid of them. We just wipe them out. We do nothing. Don't take care of them. They'll die out. We won't have to worry about it. So there were some very ugly issues around the Negro question. So around 1866, I think it was, 1867, a convention was called in Madison, Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin. It was the first meeting of an organization called the NEA, which is the National Education Association. And that was a meeting called to discuss, or can we educate the Negro? Can he be educated? And they called all of the European educational minds together to do that. Dr. Ivor Carruthers wrote a paper on that convention. And it is available online, I think. Yeah, I think it is online. And that paper talks about the agenda, what they discussed, what was the conclusion of that convention, and some of the other things. And then I've since looked that up. I went and got the minutes of the NEA, and I did some research on those minutes. And one of the things that was concluded is that we're not going to make any decisions about whether or not the education of the Negro will take place or not. We're going to leave that up to the states to do. I think that each state should make their own rule. And so even though we are a national organization, the National Education Association, the national organization, we're going to let the states make the decision on whether or not they're going to allow blacks to be educated in their state. And I don't have to tell you the horrible history around doing that, those schoolhouses that were used, where the teachers would come from, what the tools and the materials that would be used. Oh, boy, it's a voluminous amount of material around that. However, a lot in cases, education of African people did take place. But it took place because the black church stepped forward independently and did that. And they did it their way. And they could do it quietly without any interruption. They didn't take a lot of cases the white money. They didn't take a lot of times the handout scrapped up books that they used. They used their own system to do that. There was support from a few abolitionist whites who did step forward, Wilberforce, people like that. But the people themselves, and that's where we get the Booker T. Washingtons, that's where we get the Murray McLeod Bethunes and all of them coming to the paper, and they were beginning to teach, but they taught their way. And as a result, you had a cadre of young African people being educated in a different kind of light and being different. And so they were coming out able to read English, able to write English. And I want us to think about for a minute. When you decide that you want to say that black folks were illiterate and they couldn't read and write, what you are saying is that they couldn't read or write English. But African people weren't English. So they spoke their own language. They had, when Africans were brought to the New World, they spoke their own language. They read their own stuff, their African stuff, whether it was, you know, the Igbo language or whether it was Yoruba or whether it was some of the other West African tongues. But stop saying that they were illiterate just because they couldn't read English or they couldn't speak English. And the dialect that they spoke is the same dialect that Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Spanish, the Germans, and all of them had when they came here. English is a German language. It's German. It comes out of the Anglo-Saxon Tudor philosophical system. It's what it is. It's not African. So if the African couldn't speak English, it doesn't mean that they were ignorant, because that's a foreign language. What it meant is that they just didn't speak that language, because first of all, they brought over in captivity. If they brought over in captivity, you won't speak that no way. You understand that. But eventually to survive, you got to listen to survive. In order to survive, obviously they had to grasp this particular system and learn how to speak it. Because I remember coming up in school, we were told that if you didn't speak good English, that you were ignorant. So you better not say stuff like gimme and this and that. Better not say that. You know, actually, my mother would hit me. If I say, give me that over there, you know, she'd take a spoon and pow me across the head. Don't you speak that old bad English like that. Speak good English. So I think when Paul Laurence Dunbar wrote most of his poetry in dialect, what he was doing was giving support and tribute to those Africans who were had just learning to grasp the English tongue. And as I said, you're not English, so you don't speak the language. So, okay, I'm going to take a quick break come right back. And I want to open up the lines to all of my brothers that are there. And for those of you who would like to call in, area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, area code 215-490-9832. I'd love for you to call and give your opinion and your thoughts about this subject, the butt-naked truth about education for African-American people. So please do call.
Political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people for they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Greetings, brothers and sisters. We are back from our break. We thank all of you for listening to our program this evening, the Black Reality Think Tank. And we definitely encourage and invite you to give us a call. Comments, questions, area code 215-490-9832. And if you would like to email us and to obviously give us your thoughts, suggestions, critiques, and so forth, I would definitely clearly welcome that. My email address is Sankofa, S-A-N-K-O-F-A, Sankofa, underscore, B-R-T-T, B-R-T-T, at outlook.com. And I repeat, Sankofa underscore BRTT at outlook.com. And just email us. I'd love to have you do so and talk about some of the things that we're doing. I appreciate that. Let's go to our audience and see what they have to say. You know, Brother Timothy, as I think about it, you live in a powerful city, man. Philadelphia got all kind of stuff going on, and historically got not only the Liberty Bell and the copy of the Constitution, all that stuff. That ain't nothing compared to what the Black folk contribution has been. I knew about Coffin University, but I did not know that Frances Coffin had her beginnings there out of Philadelphia. I know about the AME Church, Mother Bethel. I understood that. I know about Du Bois's The Philadelphia Negro. And now I understand why he wrote about life in Philadelphia first. So anyway, what's your thoughts? You're an educator. You're a teacher. You sit in the classroom on a daily basis working with our young minds. Give us your thoughts about this butt-naked truth about education.
Well, Dr. Rogers, you know, you hit some serious chords with me, man. And when you talked about first, which is now Cheney University, and I was fortunate that I had a aunt and two cousins that graduated out of there. And as an elementary student in like the fifth grade, I saw my mom's older sister come from out of Cheney University, which was once the Institute of Colored Youth.
Right.
So young that I was so impressed. I said when I saw her actually walk down the aisle, cap and gown, and I said to my aunt, I said, "What are you going to be, a doctor, lawyer?" And it just impressed me. I said, one day I'm going to do that. And I was able to do that. And I felt very fortunate. My aunt and I talk about that because she said, "Tim, because of me, when you went to Lincoln University, you bought a Volkswagen. Because I was at Cheney University, I bought a Volkswagen." She said, "Tim, because of me, I was a teacher, you wanted to become a teacher. And because of your cousin, you wanted politics." And it was a good thing that we sometimes have people in our life, because image is very important, Dr. Rogers. But and Cheney University and Lincoln University are very important to me, right? Because my family members went there in Delaware State. I'm going to say this about Cheney. I'm not going to be long. You're talking about so many important issues here. And when you think of 1837, Cheney University starts in 18. When you talk about our friend here, Captain, our sister, the bridge that we crossed on her shoulders, Cheney University starts 1831 with a man by the name of Elliot Crescent. He's very important because he helps out Lincoln and Cheney very early. And Crescent's able to give the funding to help Lincoln and definitely Cheney. And it goes from 1837 as his founding date. I got to move on because I don't want to take up too much time. But then, Dr. Rogers, what you did, which was very important, is that you talked about the church and how it was involved.
Right.
And the church is started with Lincoln University. A man, two brothers by the name of James and Thomas Amos. And they were from Liberia. People don't know that. The co-founders of Lincoln University were Africans from Liberia. And they go to John Miller Dickey. We have a hall called Amos after the brothers, and we have a hall called Dickey Hall. They go to Oxford. It was then called Hensonville, and he wants to have a way to teach religion, and the guy denied him, Miller Dickey. He said, "Well, I'm going to send you to Princeton. I know some Princeton professors. Maybe they can help you." And so they raised money, got the bricks like Booker T. Washington did, and they started Lincoln University. It was then called Ashman Institute in 1854. It goes from 1854 to 1855. In 1866, it's the first university to have a four-year accredited degree. Now, interesting thing is that they go back to Liberia. The plan that they had at Lincoln, they did in Liberia. And the Presbyterian Church didn't help them like they were supposed to. They set them up for failure. But they did a good job. Did what they did in Liberia and came back to Lincoln. Now, interesting thing what you're saying about, because they wanted to go to Lincoln, because I think it was the woman who started the Negro College Fund. Her name is Mary Mokabathu. Am I correct?
I'm not sure.
Okay, guess what? She wanted to go to Africa, and the church wouldn't support her. It's interesting how these white supremacists play games. We want you here. We want you there. We want you to have education, but we want to control it because we don't really want you to have education. And then Dr. Rogers is interesting because during my graduate work, I started my thesis on creation versus evolution. Okay. What I was trying to put in my thesis is evolution, in which Europeans came up with the idea of, because they didn't want to say that they came from out of us. So this would make up a fairy tale, space, amphibian, reptiles, ape man. Now, Elijah Muhammad said, if they want to say they came from apes, we let them have that. We didn't come from that. Marcus Garvey used evolution in his own way. They were political footballs. He said, if they want to say they came from that, fine. But the white supremacists are denying everything that have anything to do with us, but yet they don't want us to take on our own path and our
own
way.
That's right.
Dr. Rogers, you came up, and with Dr. Clark, I mean, Dr. Clark, you know, and knowing and understanding what African is, Africa, and what Africans are to us, I'm going to ask you one question. I'm going to get somebody else before, and I'm going to come back. Is it true that Dr. Clark gave Malcolm X the idea of the AEIOU, whatever that was?
Yes. Dr. Clark told me this himself personally. I had an opportunity to introduce Dr. Clark at a gathering at the Wisconsin Black Historical Museum in Milwaukee.
Right.
Brother Claiborne Benson, who was the curator, gave me that wonderful responsibility to introduce him. After the after his lecture,
right,
I had a chance to talk to him,
right,
and I asked him, I said, Dr. Clark, I've heard that you used to teach Malcolm X on Saturday afternoons up in your apartment in Harlem. He said, yes, indeed. He said, Elijah Muhammad made him, Malcolm, and he said, Minister Prior Khan, too, at that time, because he was a student of Malcolm. They were together, and they had to go on Saturday in a classroom upstairs in the apartment of John Henry Clark. And he said, I was the one that talked to him about the independence of a movement relating to Africa. He said that to me personally. So I'm not talking something I read, because I wanted to know that. And he said that to me. So yes, he did. He did introduce that idea as along with the importance of understanding Africa as a source of your teaching. Okay, let me
You rectified for me, because I had heard that.
Go ahead. I'm sorry I had cut you. I'll come back to you, Brother Timothy. Give me a few minutes. Brother Pugh, how you doing today, my brother?
Pretty good, Dr. Rogers.
Good, good. Any thoughts on butt naked truth? You remember when Michael McGee used to say that all the time?
Yes, right. Yeah. The butt naked truth.
No, not really.
Not any thoughts in the sense that, you know, I don't know that I've got any profound things to say about education, but you know.
Okay, let me ask you this question, because I know that you're a philosopher and you do a lot of thinking. What would you say is the center of the argument about evolution creation? What's the synergy from those two ideas that they are battling at all the time? What is it that would you say is at the hub of that? What is it that's trying to be decided out of whether or not God created us or whether we evolved from the growth of the planet Earth? What would you say from your reading and your understanding, what is that? What is the hub of that argument?
It seems to me that the purpose of evolution is to free white people from any kind of constraint. If you assume that you have a creator, then that means you have a purpose, and your job is to find that, and so on. And they feel that that's a limiting view, and so evolution basically says that whatever they can come up with is fine, because there are no rules.
Okay.
You know, there are no authorities. So.
Okay. Like that. Yeah, I think so too. And that requires a in-depth discussion, but that's good. Thank you. Thank you very much for the understanding. But you're right, because very clearly that's at the hub of a lot of the early educational ideas and principles, the philosophy of early education. And for those, again, who were listening, take a look at this book called The Growth of American Thought by Merle Curti, C-U-R-T-I, M-E-R-L Curti, C-U-R-T-I. It's an old book, so you might have to go into the real archives and get it, but it's called The Growth of American Thought. And it talks about the history of all of that. And very clearly, it's all rooted at the church. Because as he indicates in the book, all of those early universities were religious institutions, Presbyterians, Episcopalians, United Methodists, all of those founded those big universities, Yale, Princeton, Brown, William and Mary, Duke University, all of them were out of a religious indoctrination. Brother Griffin, how you doing, my friend?
How you doing, Dr. Rogers?
Doing great,
As a layperson, I can't even try to get into the deep philosophical stuff that y'all are talking about, but I want to try to ask you this from a man on the street point of view.
Okay.
The debate between evolution or creation really is not a debate for me, because throughout my 60-some years, I'll be 66 if I live till the 29th of this month.
Oh, great. Okay.
The narrative has been in both of them that no matter how you put it, the white man is at the top of the hierarchy, and they're rightfully. Even if you, when I talk to theologians, white preachers, I've worked around some of the top ones in the nation, they still have a hierarchy in religion that basically the white man is doing for you, not necessarily because you are his equal, it's because that creator gave him a respect for all living life. Same reason you see white folks to this day pamper their animal and spend far more money on it than the average black person makes in a year to provide for his family. But here, before I get too far away from that, even in the evolution construct, it's a fixed position that he is the top of the hierarchy. So I leave that debate to the professionals. But I want to ask you something else. You made a statement. I think I put it in the chat to try to get it right. And it went something along with the lines of the white man wanted to civilize the African to make him human. Now, my only problem with that is, just like the analogy about that dog, the white man thinks that whatever he bestows upon you is what is given through his reign as same as manifest destiny or whatever.
That's correct.
That no matter what the construct, he is the higher and everything else is beneath him. So anything he gives you out of whether generosity, charity, whatever name you want to give, he does that out of his, quote, moral conviction. In other words, you don't have any. You don't have any more moral conviction than the dog has.
That's exactly
But he
right.
can train and help develop you so you're useful and productive and not the brute or the ape that's in the street. And another thing I want to talk about. I've had this conversation with teachers that I had at an all-black school, and I think I said before. The only time I had teachers was the first through the sixth grade, for the most part, other than a few that were white people that were compassionate through middle school and high school once we integrated, because they saw me and a few of my friends who exhibited some kind of intellect as outliers.
Okay.
That for some reason, we had the ability to process information, so they're the good Negroes, so I'm going to give them a little bit more attention, but not because they're, quote, human or special. It's just that I can mold them and shape them and wait. You keep using the word education. What they thought their job was to indoctrinate us into what to think, how to conform, respectability, politics, the whole bit. I heard you talk about wingtips versus this and that. They were not trying to educate us to think for ourselves.
Right.
They were trying to tell us what to think so they could do the same thing that we see in one of my friends in a movement now called the Decadent Veil, or your man Claude Anderson called it Showcase Negro. Since you exude some kind of exceptional quality, I'm going to pick you. I'm going to groom, water, and nurture you, but only if you will feed back what I give you. You are not free to think on your own and realize that I've given you a false construct. So I have a hard time when people interchange the words education and indoctrination. Even when we go so far as to talk about the great thing somebody did when they created a learning institution, I can tell you right now, I've seen some of the most decorated individuals come out of college, be experts like human iPods on a specific topic. I can be in their home working, and I'm going to give you a perfect example of three doctorates, one from Hampton University. I better not give too much information because you might be able to figure out who she is. But she's got several degrees.
Right.
I was doing some work in her home. There's a common wall between her bathroom and her kitchen. So when she called me and told me she wanted to expand her kitchen, being that I'm in home repair, there were but two options for me. Either you had to do away with the bathroom and put it somewhere else, or you had to extend the exterior walls. When I tried to explain to her that even on the graphic that I'd drawn out to present my proposal, you know what this woman did to me?
What's that?
She went on excoriating me by telling me, if I wanted, I'm trying to give this work to one of my fellow black people. I tell you I want that wall moved. I don't care how it's done. I just want you to do it. Do you understand where I'm going with this?
Oh, yeah.
She was an expert with degrees. And I went there trying to honor the fact that you're decorated. But you didn't even have enough common sense to understand a common wall that, by the way, had all the plumbing from both the kitchen and the bathroom. Therefore, it wasn't a standard 4-inch wall. It was, by code, a 6-inch wall, so that the plumbing and the piping at that time would be a sufficient size to leave air vents for proper flushing and operation of the plumbing system.
Right.
But I could not explain to her that if I moved the kitchen wall 2 foot toward the bathroom, I was taking away 2 foot from the toward the bathroom, that what she gained in the kitchen, she would lose in the bathroom. So I'm going to tell you again, my problem with too many of our people, and I'm going to go back to something else that you brought up, because when I first caught part of your thing, I was grilling. You brought up Frederick Douglass. I got into a heated discussion, and I'll use his name, because I think he needs to be called out publicly.
Okay.
And I have the documentation and screenshot it. Del Scott, who runs the African American Studies at Howard University, he did something that you just did in your presentation. He said when slavery ended, I'm going to tell you again, if you read the 13th Amendment, the very person that you brought up, Frederick Douglass, who was in concert with Lincoln trying to do this thing called emancipation.
Yes, that's true.
Frederick Douglass was all for Lincoln, and he met him, shook hands with him in the White House, and he sized him up to be an honorable man, and he thought that he would do the right thing. Now, Del Scott likes to talk about 1857, I believe it is, don't hold me to the exact date, when Frederick Douglass made this conversion, and then it moves on and becomes 1865, the Emancipation Proclamation.
Right.
But he won't tell you that by 1883, I believe it is, the very speech that is iconic now for the holiday that's coming up, I call this a stupendous fraud. Even Frederick Douglass, before his passing, understood that was a sham because of a single word, the first word in the 14-word exception clause. It starts out, as a matter of fact, the first time the word slavery was actually written into the Constitution. Not that slavery wasn't dealt with in the Constitution prior, because some amendments were done, I think it was the fourth that was changed, that talked about how to be compensated for the loss of runaway property. But here's my point. Douglass understood, after getting letters from all the people down south, finally going down and seeing for himself what the right of those stupendous fraud. And right to this day, some indoctrination refuses to understand the plain English that anything that comes after the word except means it's null and void or there's a carve out for it. Slavery never ended. Chattel slavery, bondage did. But it is a legal precedent that slavery has never ended. And I can tell you cases where people, like even the private corporations that were responsible for, quote, illegal aliens, detainees, refugees, or whatever, that the private prison corporations, one of them used to be Corporation, something, Corrections Corporation of America, CCA.
Okay, yeah, I know what you're talking about, CCA.
After losing a pivotal case in the Northwest, CCA, they are now court civic. But the reason they are court civic is because they lost a federal court case where their defense was it was okay to work those immigrants or detainees for free because the 13th Amendment has an exception clause once you have been, quote, convicted of a crime. Now, here's the thing. The only reason they lost is on the predicate those people may have broken the law, but they had never been prosecuted or processed duly through the court system. But their defense was the fact that slavery and addiction substitute is illegal. I'm going to leave it there and move on.
Okay, that's great. And you would get no argument out of any of that you said with me for me. I have problems with Douglass too, but I think he is a product of his time. They were all trying to.
No! Don't get me wrong, sir. I don't mean to cut you off. I don't have a problem with him. As a matter of fact, I use him in these kind of debates to make the point that I left off when I caught off too soon.
Okay.
Even Douglass was willing to change his mind once the facts were presented to him. A lot of our academics won't do that. You want to tell me your interpretation, that's why I got into it with Darrell Scott. You want to make an argument about how Lincoln did this thing and he based it off of the Missouri Compromise, not knowing that there was also a case in Vermont that actually was a predicate for how the 14th Amendment, I mean, the 13th Amendment was crafted. But you want to pick and isolate a particular fact and not look at the aggregate. And I applaud Frederick Douglass because as a fact were presented to him, he realized his conclusions were wrong. I got a lot of people who have, just like that lady I told you started the conversation about, that have been indoctrinated and have sheepskin and a whole lot of accreditation, but they have no common sense and they do not realize how to aggregate the facts and come up with a logical conclusion. You talked about it when you're talking about your theories or evolution or, right, or given principles. If you have a fallacy in that, there's no way it can be right. I worked in the Titan II missile system, and it was hard to get white folks to understand that. If you have an inherent problem built into something, you can do all kind of workarounds and reform and amendments. But unless you correct that defect, you're going to have problems. A perfect example is a problem right now with Boeing top-of-the-line jet. Rather than do the right thing and correct the problem, they try to use technology to correct it, and two of them have already hit the ground and taken lives.
Right, right, exactly. Okay, I appreciate that. And like I said, you know, Douglass had some issues that you really got to look at. I remember he was offered an ambassadorship to go to Liberia, and he refused it because he said he had a problem. He didn't think that that was the key for us to consider, and looking at the whole idea of Africa, he spoke vehemently about that. I think he even spoke down Haiti, or at some point he agreed to do the ambassadorship for Haiti, but he did not want to do Africa. And there were a lot of brothers who were considering looking at the Negro question idea of whether to go back to Africa, that a lot said, no, we don't want to go back to Africa for what? We don't want to go back there. And so as a result of that, they focused more on going to Haiti. And so there was a strong movement about going to Haiti. I think the only one that really kept it going to Africa was Paul Cuffy, and Prince Hall. Prince Hall, had brought together a group of people, to talk about, you know, the whole idea of going back to Africa. Go ahead.
I lost you there. I want to throw in one more thing. When I was younger, I was all for this idea of quote, going back to Africa. But I'm going to tell you what my problem is now that I'm 66 instead of 26. When I look at the reality, that the same white supremacist imperialistic construct is already devouring the entire continent. When you don't have control over resources, your monetary system, you're stuck in debt with the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, NGOs. I'll put it like this. People tell me about going to Africa, they're making advancements, whatever. Nigeria, one of the richest countries on that continent, has tripled its billionaires, but it's doubled its poverty. They're using the very same construct that we have here on this continent. And my whole problem is, if you're not willing to fight the enemy in the land of your birth, what good are you in Africa? I don't get it. And I wish someone would simply explain it to me instead of getting mad and calling somebody stupid, because part of intellect is being able to interrogate an idea without embracing it. But when someone asks you to break it down so it makes sense, you get mad and talk about they're denying historical facts. Number one, you already have created one thing. That history wasn't even written by you. And once you start uncovering your own, you find out just how convoluted the narrative was. We got to do better as a people. Be able to sit down and talk these things out and come to a consensus on what really makes sense. Not what you think makes sense. What really makes sense with the aggregate of the truth and the facts. That's your ideology.
Okay. All right. And I think very clearly when John Henry Clark says that Africa is our center of gravity, he goes on to say it's our cultural and spiritual mother and father, our beating heart, no matter where we live on the face of the earth. I think that we have to grapple with that and really understand what he means by that. And that's a part of our educational process that obviously we don't get in a classroom, and that's got to come from us within. But I have to give some credence to that. And I think that's...
Let me finish. I'm just going to finish with a quick
I hadn't finished my statement.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. I think we have to grapple with that, even if we have to do it in our little community schools that we're going to do. I think it has to be put on the table for discussion. I'm not saying that it's got to be, but we got to put that on the table for discussion in terms of looking at our continent and where we come from. Okay, now, what were you saying?
Well, actually, what I'm trying to say as a layperson, I agree with you 100%. Being the center of what we are means going back and making our decisions based on that real truth, not on the narrative that we've gotten as, quote, formerly enslaved people. Because so much of what we've learned here, you already know there were lies of omission, intentional distortions, that kind of thing. So I agree wholeheartedly on the premise that we have to go back to and base our stuff off of truth. And that becomes an African-centered, holistic, not all about me, not an individual striving and forget the rest of the community. That's why I brought up the analogy of the Nigerians, some brilliant Nigerians that, quote, have brought in outside forces and make money off the natural resources, but the money and the prosperity never filters down to their people because they became the same capitalist bloodsuckers
that
we got here.
Right, that's true. That's true. No doubt about that. Okay, well, you know, and a lot of our ancestors have tried to talk to us about some of these factors that are drilled into us. I go back to Carter Woodson again, the miseducation of the Negro. He says the thought of the inferiority of the Negro is drilled into him in almost every class and place that he enters, and in almost every book that he studies, it's drilled into us, this whole inferiority idea. And that's why we have to become self-educated. We have to educate our own children because we know the stories of those that have attempted to educate our children from outside of the culture. And so I think that some of those kinds of things really speaks to why we have to, you know, to do that and go back. And that's the whole purpose of this discussion tonight is to, you know, sort of look at just how to do that. Because coming up in those early years, coming out of the turn of the 20th century, and, you know, all of that ugly stuff was coming with us. It was coming into the building of America. It was the principles that established segregation. It was the stuff that gave the Klan and all of these organizations the energy, you know, we know it's not correct, but still, it was used in a way to suppress and to continue to try to keep us, you know, in a certain position and idea. And so that's why he said we were miseducated tremendously by this system. Let me read something to you real quickly. We don't have a lot of time left because I want to go back to the line again. But when they began to write encyclopedias, and as you know what an encyclopedia is, it's obviously a collection of writings by individuals, sort of like a dictionary of culture. It explains what things are and how things are made. You know, anyway, you know what a dictionary, I mean, encyclopedia is. So very early at the beginning of the 20th century, one of the first encyclopedias to come out was the Encyclopedia Britannica. And it was started in the early 1900s, around 1902, 1903. It was a whole movement called the Encyclopedic Movement. They were writing them all the way. And so they appeared. There was a term in the encyclopedia for what is the Negro. Now, if you were coming up like I was, the encyclopedia was the Bible of intellectualism. Every teacher made you do homework out of the encyclopedia. You know, that's just the way it was. I don't know. I mean, it's just part of our miseducation process. We had to use the encyclopedia a lot of times to learn. But here is what the Encyclopedia Britannica had for the Negro and what that is. And this is what he said. He said, mentally, the Negro is inferior to the white. This remark is F. Manetta, made after a long study of the Negro in America. See, there's a lot of studies done about African people in America, who we were. This may be taken as generally true. This is what the encyclopedia says, that statement can be taken as generally true of the whole race. The Negro children are sharp, intelligent, and full of vivacity. But on approaching the adult period, a gradual change sets in. This is the Encyclopedia Britannica now. The intellect seems to become clouded, animation giving place to a sort of lethargy, briskness yielding to indolence. We must necessarily suppose that the development of the Negro and the white proceeds on different lines. While with the latter, of the volume of the brain grows with the expansion of the brain. And the former, the growth of the brain, is one that is contrarily arrested by the premature closing of the cranial structures and the lateral pressure of the frontal bone. And I'm not going to read any more of that garbage. But this is the way the academic community was attempting to address that. And so when you start talking about going to Harvard or Yale or Cornell, this is the thing that these schools of higher learning saw in the African. And even with Du Bois, Du Bois was looked at by his white colleagues in a different kind of way. I mean, it wasn't like he was smart. It's like, you know, he had captured some things, I guess in a lot of cases they said, based on his white father. And through that idea, race mixing might be the answer for African Americans. That might be the way to go. Because as Dr. Brother Grissom just texted me, he said they were freaks of nature. And that's true. It would be like if somebody came on television and said, I got a monkey that can type. And so the monkey started typing, and it was actually typing, you know, what you could read. That would just awe people. I mean, they wouldn't necessarily say he's superior and give him a job typing in their company. He's just a freak of nature. They'd probably put him in the circus, and they would have the circus to do that. And that's a lot of times what did happen. And so it's the same process. So why am I saying all of this? Why am I talking about this? All of this is a very strong and dominant argument why we need to self-educate our children, ourselves, and our community. We have got to study that. We've got to look at that. We've got to use our stuff. I can't go get a book on Freud to understand my psychology. Freud didn't know anything about me. And what he's talking about has nothing to do with me in a cultural way. He doesn't know what the stress system that I have is like. He didn't understand the problem of what the transatlantic slave trade did and how it impacted our system. So for me to study Freud and Jung and Carl Rogers and some of those other psychologists is just a waste of time. And we do that. We try to do that. And we try to look at them. We try to look at what people said about economics and making money and how that should work. That's not the way Africans made money. That's not the way they used the resources. It's the way that Karl Marx brings forward and some of the other economist ideas that we see floating around. But we are taught that that's the way we should do that. So we've got to retract all that stuff and look at our own method of learning and understanding. Brother Timothy, let me come back over here to you a minute and see what you might want to say. Hold on a minute. The computer is dragging here for a second. It's not opening. Okay, here we go. So anything you want to close out? We got about 5 minutes. I wanted to come back to you.
Yes, sir. I'm going to close out, sir, with I think they have a book out, it's been out for a while, called The Slave Bible. And I think they used that in the past on the plantations with preachers that look like me and you to preach to the African. Say another thing, sir, that around the time that Dr. Clark died, I think he died in the 90s, and a woman came out with a book, Not Out of Africa. So they back then, in stating that they want to be independent of Africa, they say they're from space reptiles to mammals to gorilla or the great ape.
Yeah, that was Murray Lefkowitz.
I've always had an argument with some of the folks that come out of the African American Studies Department, because Asante uses Diop's work, which is a lot of it is great. But one thing I disagree with when it comes to Dr. Asante and Diop is that he says that we come from the great ape, according to Diop. We came from the great ape out of the trees. We learned to walk from fours to twos. I disagree with that. I really do. My thing is that people use that politically, and I'll go with Francis Crest Welsing's. I will go with the Iceman's heritage. I will go with the lack of melanin. I will go with the Ice Age, the glacier period. Okay. They once looked like us, and they became mutations.
There we go.
As opposed to them coming from outer space, amphibians, reptiles, and animals.
I agree 100%. Okay. Well, we're at our end here. I really appreciate those of you who were on and your comments. I appreciate Brother Griffin. Had heard from you in a while. I'm so glad you're here. Brother Pugh, thank you for joining and listening. I know that you all, my brother Timothy from Philadelphia, you might have been trying to reach me earlier on phone. My cell phone is missing. I'm phoneless right now. And same as Sister Ayan, I know you were on just a few minutes ago when you hung up. You may have tried. You won't be able to reach me until I get a replacement phone, which I'm going to be doing next day or so. But what I'll do is that when we go off the air here, I will stay on this for a minute if you wanted to ask me some specific question. We won't be on the air, but if you wanted to talk a minute after this, I'll close this out and go off the air. And the same is here, Sister Yarn. You can give me a call back into the switchboard here, and I'll be on a few minutes for if you wanted to ask me some other additional questions. But anyway, I really appreciate all of you. We'll be back next week discussing these issues for change. We gotta keep discussing them. We can't let it go. So have a wonderful week, my brothers and sisters, and remember the words of Marcus Garvey: "Up, you mighty race! You can accomplish what you will. Up, you mighty race! You can accomplish what you will." Great. Have a great week, and I will see you next Tuesday.
Thank you, sir. It's been great.
Shame, oh yeah, it's a mighty shame. Oh Lord, it's a bad feeling. fall, you're bound to burn down. Babylon, you're bound to fall. What a shame, it's a bloody shame.